Blog Talk Radio.
Are you there, Jeannie? Are you there, Michael?
Well, I am here. Can you hear me, Dr. Tim?
I do. I hear you.
I was waiting on the music, and it never happened.
Yeah. Be careful. It might start any moment now, but...
Yeah, really. So, welcome to Blog Talk Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Mindshifters Radio, with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. You heard Dr. Tim Hayes, and I'm Jeannie Rice, and we welcome you to the show. And today is Thursday, August the 13th, 2015. And our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions, because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael. Michael, are you there?
I am. This phone is just funky for getting the mute button turned off. So, got about 4 buttons to push, and sometimes it doesn't jump. But anyway, thank you for the introduction. Delighted to be and honored to have this opportunity to share this ancient technology of forgiveness. And I'm hoping that maybe Ron is on, and we can just pick up and continue the conversation from yesterday about the filters. Is Ron with us?
Well, let me scan through the numbers. Ron, if you're on there, press 1 and it'll pop you up to the top. Do not see him yet.
Well, Michael,
I'll keep watching for him.
Before you get lost into something,
go for it.
I would just like to say, I think we have an excellent opportunity to talk about filters and perception and what gets stimulated in me when I hear something based on that letter that we were talking about yesterday. Did you get a chance to read what I sent you? If you're responsible.
I have not had the chance to read the letter yet, Tim. No, I got it.
Okay.
But so I've got a crashed computer.
Okay, so let's talk about this, and I can read parts to you so you'll see what I'm saying.
Great, please do.
My take on this is that, and I've heard you say this a number of different times, this is at the core of our work. If I hear that somebody in a position of authority and power wrote in a letter that said, let's manipulate these people. Let's say we have limitless resources and people will yield themselves to us with perfect docility to our molding hand, and we will not teach them to be preachers or politicians or statesmen or musicians or painters or great artists. If I hear that that happened and that someone implied from that conversation or whatever letter I'm reading that someone has been manipulating our culture to keep us suppressed, and it stirs anger or resentment or hopelessness in me, my first job must be to dismantle the brain cells, the energy in me of anger, resentment, hopelessness, helplessness, etc. Because until I do that, I haven't restored my mind to its high-functioning state of what Michael Rice calls human life, which is the energy of creation, which is the energy of love, which means I have a filter over the frontal lobes of my mindset to loving intentions and a filter over the back lobes of my mindset to loving perception. And I have this condition of perfect love in my mind, and only then can I perceive accurately. And if there has been then someone who is trying to manipulate me or my children or our culture and keep us down, then I will have access to high-level, spiritual faculties to help me decide what to do in the most loving, respectful, effective way to make a change for the better. And if I decide to act out of anger, sadness, fear, hopelessness, helplessness, I will have no chance of being able to understand the laws of nature, the laws of God, the laws of the Creator, the natural laws about how my mind-body-energy system works and how the world I live in works, and whatever I do is most likely to be at least ineffective and most likely contributing to a problem. So, Michael Rice, yesterday or the day before, was talking about this quote where Frederick T. Gates, who was part of an education department set up by Rockefeller, said, and here's what's often quoted, and it's quoted on a website that promotes itself as helping people come out from under the thumb of oppression. In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or of science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, or musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply. So this quote in that is cut off right there, so it's taken out of context. That's not the end of the quote. And it's taken out of the context in which this piece of writing fit very nicely. And just like Dr. Michael Rice says, and Dale Allen Hoffman says, if you take the ancient Aramaic and you translate it into Greek and you take little chunks of it, you can use it to not only say something different than what was intended by the original authors, but say something that looks like the exact opposite of what the original author intended. So, for instance, the Bible says many, many times, fear not, fear not, fear not. Most religions today are based on fear, fear of God, fear of retribution, fear of going to hell, etc. So I did some work after our call yesterday, and it took me about 15 minutes to go through different links and keep searching to find the original document, or what is purported to be the original document. I'm not trying to tell you I have the absolute truth here. However, here is, and it's available if you just keep looking and you don't just go for excerpts, the content from an original source, and the title of the paper was "The Country School of Tomorrow, in which young and old will be taught in practicable ways how to make rural life better, beautiful, intelligent, fruitful, recreative, healthful, and joyous," by Frederick T. Gates, chairman of the Central Education Board. So he goes on to say, thrown on a screen at a recent conference of rural life was a series of photographs of country schoolhouses, and it depicts, now I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but the larger number of these schoolhouses were small one-room structures set on pegs, weather blackened, window smashed, often wrecked entrance steps and a lockless door. For a chimney, a length of stovepipe thrust through the side or the back. For furniture, a perpendicular combination of a bench, desk, well fitted to be an engine of torture. Improvement of the grounds had barely been conceived. On the contrary, what was a natural setting, a beauty of nature, had been defaced and belittered. From November onward, for 3 to 7 months, somewhat less than one half of the school population of the district may be found there, usually taught by a young girl, often last year's older pupil of this or a neighboring school either, and you enter, and you shall see her painfully teaching her class to read sentences of English, and what you're going to see in the photographs are groups of pupils and teachers alike suffering from hookworm disease, emaciated, misshapen, bloated bodies, sad, pale, listless faces, hopeless faces marked with habitual suffering, faces which no art could charm into a smile that would be anything but ghastly. And these faces told the story of disease and neglect. There are well nigh or quite near 2 million of these children in the South. We're talking about 1903, I believe, when this paper was written. Between 6 and 16 years of age, weighed down, arrested, and stunted physically by mentally by this disease, many thousands each year finding relief from it in death. This number must be multiplied by indirect toll to because of the increase of other disease fatalities, and it's only traceable after lots of work to discover the numbers. 60,000 people, most of them children, have already been treated in North Carolina alone, and the work has been conducted systematically in only a few counties. Here's a word picture drawn by one of the superintendents of the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission of the crowds of numbering several hundreds that throng his dispensaries. Now, they're trying to get medicines to these people for hookworm and nutrition because they're so malnourished. This superintendent of the Rockefeller Commission says, "The people come from far and near, from all stations in life. They come on trains, by boat, in wagons, carts, and buggies. Many come on foot from 10 to 20 miles away. Some are too weak to make the journey, and falling by the wayside are picked up by passing vehicles and brought in. Some are unable to stand or sit. Some are brought on stretchers. The results following the treatment are indeed marvelous. A weight gain of a pound a day is common. To see the crowds, to witness their transformation from invalidism, wasted ambition, and poverty to health, happiness, and activity and prosperity brings to one mind the miracles of New Testament and the healing of the multitudes." So it goes on to detail, in the late 18, early 1900s, in this country, the misery, the poverty, the disease in these rural areas was so rampant that it's the kind of thing we now would attribute to third world countries. So then it goes on to say, here's a vision of the remedy. Is there aught remedy for this neglect of rural life? Let us at least yield ourselves to the gratifications of a beautiful dream that there is. In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves to perfect docility. So now here is the quote. And then it goes on to say, here is, instead of forcing these people to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic when they don't even have food and they're suffering from diseases and they're being ridiculed because they won't fit into this little slot that we have in our upper echelon ideal of what society should be, then they go on to say things like, health is the first lesson. Our first plans shall be for health as the basis of all well-being and well-doing. We shall ferret out the local issues that cause ill health in the family and the community, also in the plant and animal life. We shall call to our aid the experts from the chemical, agricultural colleges and universities, full schools of forestry and veterinary medicine. They will examine and report and give us the best tools to help these communities. Closely associated with the health is the daily supply of food. Quoting the scriptures here, I was hungered and you gave me meat. It shall be sufficiently varied, regularly provided, suitably and appetizingly cooked. Every girl and boy shall be taught what to eat, and how to cook at least 3 times a day throughout his life. Every one of us must eat, and the question of healthful and nutritious diet is perhaps the most single important question in life. Nor lives the man to whom this very thing is not providence designed to be inconsiderable part of his daily satisfactions. So, then comes the question of shelter. We will help them have appropriate shelter. Then there comes the question of clothing. We will not just make sure they have clothing. We will teach them how to design, cut the fabric, and make their own clothing that's appropriate. We have lost, now this is a paraphrase, sanitary clothing is not just important. We call to mind that for a past century, the number of people that died on the Titanic, at least that many children have gone to death every month in the South for lack of knowledge of a few simple facts about hygiene, clothing, and nutrition. Our work of hygiene will be the next. And then lessons in farming. We will teach these people how to farm so that they can make quality food with less effort. And then what are we going to teach them in school? Here's a quote. As for the schoolhouse, we cannot even now plan the building, or rather the group of buildings. Quite likely we would not recognize the future if the plan were put before us today. So different will it be from the traditional schoolhouse. For one thing, we may be sure. Our schools will no longer resemble, in their methods and their discipline, institutes of penal servitude. They will not be, as they are now, places of forced confinement. They will not be accompanied by physical and mental torture during 6 hours of the day. Straitjackets, which are now called educational, will no longer thwart and stifle the physical and mental activities of the child. We shall, on the contrary, take the child from the hand of God, the crown and glory of his creative work, by him, God, pronounced good, and by Jesus pronounced blessed. We shall seize the restless activities of his or her body and mind, and instead of repressing them, we shall stimulate those activities as the natural forces of growth and education. We shall seek to learn the instincts of each child and reverently to follow and obey them as guides to his or her development. I'm adding the word her. This was the early 1900s. For those instincts were the voice of God within him, teaching us the direction of his unfolding. We will harness the natural activities of the child to his natural aspirations and guide and help him in their realization. The child naturally wishes to do the things that adults do, and therefore the operations of adult life form the imitative plays of the child. The child lives in a dreamland full of glowing hopes of the future and seeks anticipatively to live today the life of his manhood. It goes on, and there are other quotes in this paper that sound like Dr. Michael Rice himself submitted the transcript. How many of us go to look at the source? And I want to put in here that this does not rule out that captains of industry have not taken over our educational system and made it the opposite of what this paper says they wanted to make it. The point I'm trying to make here is Frederick T. Gates was being maligned and misquoted out of context in a way to make what he had planned and written in this paper look like the exact opposite. And when I get stirred to anger or fear or sadness about that, my first job must be to apply the tool of ancient Aramaic forgiveness to remove the sources within my mind-body-energy system of those negative emotions if I want to have any hope of viewing my actual circumstances accurately. I'll take a breath, and Michael, you can chime in.
Great. Awesome. I did got the letter opened on my notebook. My computer has crashed, so I was kind of reading along with you most of the way. And certainly the whole objective was to uplift the people of the community that were in obviously tragic circumstances. And sadly, some of those circumstances still exist in some places in the South and some places in the North as well. There's still some pretty bizarre stuff going on.
Well,
of course,
But my point is, it's still happening as the mess that Frederick T. Gates was trying to address and correct. Right? We all admit that school is much like, still, much like what he was talking about here, where people are being taught to sit down and don't have interactions with your peers and be quiet and listen to what I tell you. But that's the opposite of what Frederick T. Gates was trying to promote.
Well, in a sense, of course, the context of the conversation we were having yesterday was the difference between the driven life, the controlled life, and the inspired life. And, you know, I still, you know, was there the goal to uplift? Absolutely, no question about it. And was there the goal to instill in these children's minds those things that would put them into a higher level of servitude that would serve the purpose?
But that's not from Gates. If you were able to follow what I just said, that's why I kept reading as long as I did. He clearly writes in his paper about teaching people to live from the inspiration from their creator that each child has particular, peculiar interests and passions, which is not our department to define, but to help them unfold it, because it's the voice of God within him teaching us the direction of the child's unfolding. If that isn't living by inspiration, just according to what we were talking about yesterday, I don't know what is. I've completely misunderstood you if that doesn't fit your definition.
Well, I hear you loud and clear, but we need to put in context that Gates also wrote the part that we were talking about yesterday that says we shall not be interested in, you know, the words, and these are his words, is there aught of remedy for this neglect of rural life? Let us at least yield ourselves to the gratifications of the beautiful dream that is here. In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. And he goes on to say that we'll work our own good. Are they uplifting people? Absolutely. But I hear his words about inspiration from God, but there's definitely a conflict between those two statements.
Okay.
Don't you think?
I don't think so. I think that comes with the filter. Remember, words don't have the meaning. The brain cells have the meaning. So if you look at it this way, in the context, remember an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? You remember that whole thing? How could they say that? Well, he's justifying that, you know, I get to go cut somebody's hand off or take their eye out. In the context of, and I've heard you give this talk before, if you look at it and say, wait a minute, they're trying to step it down from, if somebody stole an apple from my cart, I have the right to go wipe out their whole village, right? And so they're just trying to say, look, let's just make the punishment fit the crime, if that's the idea. If you read the whole thing and you understand the context that he was addressing, back then, they were trying to force people into what they thought their skills would best be, and then it would be like if you had somebody living in Russia and they were good at gymnastics, the child doesn't have a choice. They're plucked away from their family and they're trained up in gymnastics, even if that wasn't the kid's passion. So if you read that quote in context, that we won't try to make them this, we won't try to make them that, we won't try to make them that, rather we will listen to the child's own instincts and reverently follow and obey them as guides to his development, for those instincts were the voice of God within him. If you put that together, now I'm not trying to tell you that this is what Rockefeller did or that's what's happened in our culture. I clearly acknowledge that's not how it's developed at most in our culture. I'm just trying to point out, if you read the whole paper by Frederick T. Gates, you probably have a very different perspective. And more to my point is, anybody who reads one paragraph or a take on it and is filled with anger or fear or sadness, hopelessness or confusion, if they hope to have an accurate perception, they must first have this rakama. Upon these hang the law and all its prophets. I know you can talk more to that, so I'll back off.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I'm in 100% agreeing with you. That's absolutely the place to go with whatever we're doing. That's the whole, of course, purpose of the work. And I read the overall picture differently than you do, and that's okay.
Yeah, my point is not about the reading of the picture. My point is about the emotions that get stirred in us and whether or not we take a partial report from someone that stirs something in us and we go run with it without checking out the resources or without setting the love filters first and then understanding that that might give us a far better or a far different perspective to take when we decide to take actions.
Cool. Awesome. Any other thoughts?
Nope, that does it for me, and I'm hoping that Ron calls in and we can get back to the filters, because I think it ties right in. I mean, whatever filter I have set is going to clearly drive or control my perception. And
absolutely. Definitely one of the most basic principles of the work. So let's check with Jeannie and see if Brother Ron has called.
He is, and he's on the air.
Awesome. Let's say hello. Welcome, sir. Are you with us, Ron? Hello, Ron. We're here. Did we lose him?
No, he's still on there, and I've got him turned on.
Hi,
so,
Ron?
Oh, there he is.
Ah, there he is. Hey, sir.
Hi. How's it going?
We're rocking. How about you?
Some technical difficulties here.
I understand.
Yeah.
Been there, done that.
So I think I'm gonna have to go and attend to a work commitment here soon. But I remember yesterday you had gone through the discussion of the Rakhma filter and had not made the transition to talk in depth about the Kuba filter. And that's kind of how we left it, I think.
It is. It is. We had covered the idea that, for those who weren't listening yesterday, and you can go back, of course, to the archives and pick up that show, but just a synopsis, we were talking about the filters in the mind and explaining that you can go to our website, whyagain.org, and if you click on the bullseye, you may have to scroll down a little bit, click on the bullseye, then in the middle of the page, then you'll see a series of links open. If you look down that series of links, you'll see a schematic of the mind. You'll see a link to that, and you can download it and have a look. But in essence, frontal lobes of the brain hold our intentions, three filters, rakhma, the word in Aramaic. The closest we could come to that, we'd have to put two English words together to start to approximate it, but it would be intentional love, a filter over intentions, and then there's fear and hostility. And each filter allows a certain quality of intentions to flow or become available from the frontal lobes of the brain. And then that pool of intentions, whatever the intentions are, then become the raw material of our goals. And so when one selects an intention and makes a commitment to its achievement. So let's say, you know, I'm going to go to the movies, I'm going to go to a workshop. We'll keep the explanation short. And once I elevate one of those intentions, I'm thinking about going to a movie, I'm thinking about going to a Y workshop, once I elevate one of those to a goal, I make a commitment to it, then what happens is my intention becomes a goal. And the functioning purpose of a goal is to generate stress. And the functioning purpose of the mind is to give us the best behaviors possible to achieve that goal. So if I decide that I'm going to go to the workshop on Saturday, then what my mind is going to do is start giving me a series of behaviors for the achievement of that. So the behaviors might be, I'm going to look on Google for the address. Oh, first of all, I have to find the flyer with the address on it. And then I'm going to Google the address. I'm going to see how long it's going to take me to get there, what part of town it's in. Gee, it's just before dinner time or just after dinner time, so I'm going to look on Google Maps to see where I'm going to eat. You know, there was that spiffy girl that I saw, and I heard she was going to be there, so I want to make sure I've got the right clothes on. Oh, I have to do laundry to get some decent clothes, or I have to go to the laundromat, or I have to go to the dry cleaner. So a number of behaviors issues from that goal where if I'd made the choice to go to the movie, I wouldn't be doing any of those things. I know that I'm going to eat popcorn when I get to the movie. I'm going to be in just a pair of shorts and a t-shirt because I don't care how I look. There's nobody there I'm meeting. I'm just going to go to the movie. And I'm not going to look the movie theater up on the internet because I already know where it is. I've been there 1,000 times. So a whole different set of behaviors comes from that goal to go to the workshop or the goal to go to the movies. And then perception, like intentions, has a quality. And there are 3 filters over intentions. Over perception, the same way as there are 3 filters over intentions. The first filter is that of Rachma. In intentions, the matching filter is Kubo in Aramaic, over perception. Once again, we could put 2 English words together and say that that filter is a filter of perceptual love. So the pool of perceptions available to build my guidance system is that which is based in love when my intentions or my perceptions come through Rachma. If one of the 2 other filters, and once again we talked yesterday about, you know, by their fruit, you know, how do you tell where somebody's really at? Well, one of the fruits of the human being is what comes from the mind. And so if hostility happens to be the active filter over perception, then that hostility filter will only allow units of perceptual memory key to threat to come forward. So the mind is going to tend to formulate a reality based in threat if hostility is the active filter over perception. It's going to tend to create a picture, a construct out of love if Kubha is the active filter. And then the 3rd possible filter is that of fear. And if fear is the active filter, then the mind is going to produce a reality based in threat. Did I say threat for hostility? I meant irritation. So we've got 3 possible qualities of perception: loving, threatened, irritated. And the you all probably at some point bought a game for a child, a little toy. It's usually a wooden box with several different shaped blocks in it. And, you know, only the round block will go through the round hole, so the child's learning shapes. Only the triangular block will go through the triangular hole. Only the square block will go through the square hole. Well, perception works in a similar fashion in that if one filter or another is active, then the mind is going to tend to squeeze through its content, its perception, to match the output of that filter. And so it would seem to behoove one to understand that the highest and best evidence, so if you go to a courtroom and you bring in a photocopy of a document, the judge is going to say, do you have the original of this document? And you say, yeah, well, yeah, it's back home in the safe. Well, then please get in your car and go home and get it, because this is not the highest and best evidence. The original document is the highest and best evidence. Well, in the same way, Rachma and Kubha are filters. And, you know, in the Aramaic, when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in all the law? He said, have Rachma when you think of any object of attention. First order of business. That's going to start to set a chain reaction that will tend to bring perception through Kubha which is going to be the most loving and the highest and best evidence your mind can possibly give you. The two filters, as we said yesterday, step together in the ancient Aramaic were called perfect love. When they said perfect love casts out fear, what they were saying is, if you have those filters set, even though there may be a circumstance in front of you that could inspire fear, if those filters are set, your mind isn't going to go into that space of threat or irritation. It's going to tend to stay on track with love. So, Ron, are you still with us? Were you able to hang with us that long?
Oh, yeah, and I am still here. I'm on mute on another call, but I am, that fits in with, you know, as you know, I've been a really conscientious student of yours for a long time and continue
Absolutely.
To be. And what I'm refining in my mind as I listen to you talk, the insight that felt to me like an intuitive event last Thursday is that there's, and maybe this is just from my own learning, but there's a piece to Rachma and Kubla, those filters and what they are filters over, that has to do with the directional flow of attention. As my attention flows out into the world and as my attention flows in from the world. And there's an element to that that feels to me that might be another dimension to explore in our evolving understanding of what Yeshua was talking about. And I'm not, you know, as there is such profound, you know, there's a little moment like those moments you have with the magic eye things where you look and it becomes three-dimensional. Where my attention can sometimes be flowing outwards from me, and other times it can be, and this is all in my imagination, my attention is flowing in towards me from the world. And then the words Rachma and Kubla came up, and it was like I got excited, and I got this energy, infusion of energy as I contemplated that. Maybe this is just something that's going on inside me as I do my work, but maybe there's something here to share over time that, to discover, to enhance understanding of these words. Or maybe it's something that already is well within the context of what you understand, and I'm just kind of catching on finally. I'm not sure.
Well, it sounds like a powerful live process for you, and
yeah.
That's the whole process of the work is to keep that live process going and, of course, to uplift and share with each other how
yeah,
that unfolds.
There's a lot to NLP that's a relatively recent discipline that was developed in the 70s, and the guys who developed it were not anyone that I would want to follow or treat as role models, but they did come up with some pretty incredible ways of breaking down patterns within human thought that are useful, a different perspective to look at and useful. And I'm wondering if there may be a piece of the puzzle in my own understanding of Yeshua's work that's being enhanced by my efforts in that study as well. Because the work that you do is just so rich. I mean, my God, there's so much that you offer. It's encyclopedic, to say the least.
Well, I for one appreciate you being on the team and bringing your experience level by level, and I stand back in awe and appreciation for the work that you're doing on an ongoing basis.
Thank you so much.
The shift you've made in your family.
Thank you. And if nothing else, even if it's got nothing to do with Rachma and Kubla, I mean, even if I just take that out of the equation, let's just say, forget that it has anything to do with those definitions, because that might be something I completely made up. It's really fun to walk through the world and say, okay, here's what I think of them, and here's what they think of me, and kind of play with, because of course it's all when I say what they think of me, that's all made up, right? That's really what I think they think of me.
Right.
But it's a good check. It's a great checking point for me to just think of it that way. Like, what do I think of them? What do they think of me? And if I can hold love in both of those cases, then I can walk in any situation. And when I imagine, let's say I walk in and I see you, Michael, and you have a look on your face, and I say, what does he think of me? Well, he's looking askance at me. He thinks I have issues. But then I go, wait a minute. I'm going to play with Makik. I'm going to play with humility. And I'm going to find the highest and best in him. Not only the highest and best in you, but I'm going to go to a level where you perceive me as love. And so I'm going to go deeper in myself to perceive the level of you where you perceive me as love. And so now I'm in that place where as my attention flows out to you, I'm flowing it out through love. And as I imagine your attention flowing back through me, I'm imagining it coming through love. And it's just so much fun.
Powerful way to shift the output of the mind. Yes, absolutely. Okay. And of course, as you speak about what one person thinks about another, it all becomes perception. It all has to flow through those filters. What are the intentions involved in my mind when I look at you and want to know what you think of me? What filter do I have set over my intentions? Then what filter do I have set over my perceptions? And that's going to end up creating my construct of what you think of me.
Exactly. And it fits in perfectly. It's just another way for me to play with it. Yeah.
Yep.
It isn't as much additive as it is another game within that context, you know, another game to play for me and for others who resonate with it. To what level do I have to go to perceive that you love me, even if you're looking at me with what I think is hostility? You know, what level do I have to go? And that ties right into one of my favorite teachings that I ever got from you, Michael, which is the definition of humility, which is to perceive and cooperate with the highest and best in others. And then we shall, from the Beatitudes, we shall gain the earth. And that makes so much sense. Maybe you could explain that a little bit for those who may not know that Beatitude, because that's just kind of think goes right to what we're talking about, doesn't it? The Beatitude about humility and why it is that way.
Well, certainly the opposite of the Greek idea that we've been fed in the culture of, you know, grovel in the earth like a worm, and then you've got humility. And how people have used that idea to drive others into the ground, where, in fact, in Aramaic, it's a mental quality of looking for and cooperating with the highest and best in others. Now, that doesn't mean if somebody's standing there with a gun at your head that you can't acknowledge that there's something here that I need to deal with, this gun pointed in my head. You know, there's something that needs to happen in the way of behavior for me, and I'll get the best guidance out of my structure. I'll get the best construct possible for the best outcome if I'm connected to Rockman Kuba. Because by so doing, I have access not only to the content of my own carbon-based memory, but I have access to yours too.
Yeah.
You have access to a guide, a power that flows through the whole universe and is willing to teach me.
As I see the highest and best within you, I'm leveraging projection for my own benefit because I'm strengthening that within me.
Exactly. Just a simple act of perception means that I gather an energy, and you know, it's kind of like the opposite of the law of sowing and reaping. In this case, I'm reaping from you. If I'm seeing your highest and best, I'm reaping something wondrous from you that maybe I haven't even started to develop in me. And by reaping that, I sow that in my own field, and I get to share it, and vice versa. So the benefit of humility, as it was taught in the Aramaic, of seeing that highest and best and cooperating with that. And and being able to address the gun pointed all becomes part of the process. And, of course, to get the highest possible construct, recognizing that every picture that we see is a picture painted on the inside of our eyeballs, out of the content that's moving in us, yes, stimulated by the world, but in truth, never seeing outside of ourselves through our eyes, we're seeing a construct based upon what's resonated in us. So we've got kind of a combination of, yes, there was an event. I wouldn't be thinking about a gun if there wasn't somebody there with a gun in their hands, canceled the thought. So that's obviously part of the equation, but then what does that gun resonate with me? What does it move in me? If it's fear, then as Dr. Tim was saying, I want to get to work on that fear and dissolve it rather quickly. Because whatever it is that I have fear about, I'm going to tend to draw it to me. I'm going to tend to create that result. And so as I enter into forgiveness and keep moving back to resetting the filters, keep moving back to the presence of love, then I get to produce totally different outcomes.
And
if they're based in humility, the outcomes are going to tend to be higher than if they're based in some sort of criticism or condemnation, because, of course, once again, if I'm into criticizing or condemning, then with that criticism or condemnation, I'm reaping an energy. I'm sowing that energy in my field, and I'm going to produce tensions and perceptions based on that which is active. And that's going to tend to defile perception, create a lower quality of perception, in which case it's going to be a whole lot easier to make mistakes and create outcomes I'd rather not have than if I have Rockman and Kuba set.
Awesome.
Yeah. Dr. Tim, you have any thoughts there?
The highest thought. Ditto.
Okay.
Well, that's one of the attitudes that, you know, where they talk about gaining the earth. I mean, if you want to look at it from a worldly standpoint, you know, wanting to do well in business or in wealth, financial wealth, you can say, as I perceive, you know, the highest and best in everyone, it's no coincidence that that person would gain the earth, because they're walking around about, you know, attracting or perceiving and strengthening within themselves the best qualities and the most productive and useful qualities in others, if they're, especially, you know, if they've got those filters set.
Right on.
And
as a great man I know once said, ditto.
You know, when I first started working with you, Michael, one of the profound, what I would have been satisfied with was just to thank God I met you who could provide me with, which is what I needed, which was I paid attention in church. I paid attention in the philosophy that I was raised in. I attempted to apply them. And to be able to, you know, and I have all those philosophies stored in my system, both in my own lifetime and generationally. And then to have you come along and say, hey, here's the same teachings, but a sane version. You just need to learn the sane version of what, you know, the original teachings were before they were distorted. And it became just such a joyous task for me to go, oh my God, and challenging too, to say, oh my God, I can keep all this teaching I invested in, I can just relearn. And now, one of the other things that's been a great gift from you to me is when I see you and I'd be kind of down in the pit or wherever, and I hear you say, you know, I've been doing this work for 33 years and I had no idea. The last 5 days have been the most amazing yet. Or, you know, I've been doing it for 40 years, and the last 5 years have been better than ever. Because, you know, people like me, we need to hear that. We need to hear that whatever level we're at, you know, Yeshua's teachings do make all things new, and this next moment can be a new moment for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, sadly, it would appear that the thing that mostly went missing, and what's been my focus, you know, my background's in electronics and if you were designing, repairing, building a piece of electronic equipment, it really didn't matter what your philosophy was. Did it work on the other end? If it didn't work, it wasn't much use. And so to me, in looking into these things, what it's always been about is, how do we get it to something that works that we can hand off and make available to someone else? How do we do that? And that's the piece that's missing. I mean, you know, for example, if you hear people saying things, and it's a very high accolade, a very high thought, you know, love your neighbor. Well, if you're in front of a neighbor who resonates hostility and fear in you, and nobody's giving you the tool with which to remove your hostility or fear, you can't even, not even having the conversation about what love actually is a state of being, it's not a verb, but letting that conversation go. But if you're in front of someone that resonates your hostility or fear, and nobody showed you responsibility for your hostility or fear and how to remove it, you just set that person up. When you said love your neighbor, you just set them up for failure. Because if that neighbor, you know, if it's like if I hit a middle C tuning fork on a desk and I put it in front of a second tuning fork, the second tuning fork has no choice about it. It's going to start to vibrate. It's going to start to move.
Oh, then
if I stand in front of someone with unresolved hostility or fear, then they trigger that. That's going to start to move in me. Loving my neighbor is a joke in that context.
Oh.
If I don't have the tool with which to remove the hostility and fear.
It gets worse because then they double down and they say, you're a sinner if you don't love your neighbor.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's a setup for failure.
It's a setup for failure, and then when you fail, it's like they double down on the failure because now you've got that double, you get that double, that squaring effect of what failure means.
Yep.
And, you know, I say that to people in recovery all the time when they're going through their process, and I'll be like, well, you're upset today. You're going through some stuff today. But you know, what I'm hearing you tell me now is, now you're upset because you're upset. Just be upset. You know, just have a bad day. Don't double down and beat yourself up for having a bad day, you know?
Exactly. And by the way, the tool to remove what your bad day is about.
Yes.
And there, of course, for anybody who's listening, and you know, maybe you're new to the show, there's the key tool in the whole process, and that's the tool of forgiveness. And forgiveness being a tool for removing content that puts us in that space of hostility or fear. And so when you hear from the Aramaic, love your neighbor, first of all, it says have a rock, but keep this condition in your mind active, and you're going to have the best perception possible for interacting with your neighbor in a constructive way. If your neighbor resonates hostility or fear and you've practiced keeping Rachma and Kubba active, then the simple act of that hostility or fear passing through the Rachma and Kubba filters is going to begin to transmute that energy. It's going to change it, and it's going to start to disappear. And then when you actively go into the forgiveness process, you get to directly access the parts of the mind that hold the hostility or fear and remove it. So that situation where, as you're talking about the doubling down, now you're a sinner, now you're bad, and you're going to get punished and blah, 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 blah. Now, with that tool, it becomes, oh, thank you, neighbor, for showing me this hostile part of my mind. Man, am I ever glad to see this. I welcome the opportunity to heal this, and I appreciate you for showing it to me. Which is only going to be something that's going to tend to come through Rachma and Kubba. Perception of the highest and best possibility. When one's in hostility or fear, they can't see the possibility because their perception is degraded. It's defiled. You know, one can't see the options. You know, a situation comes up where, gee, you know, here I think I'm being abused, and I go into a rant and rave about being abused, when in fact all I had to say, if I'd have had Rachma set, all I had to say was, oh, okay, well, I'm going to just let go of that. And I've been finished with it. But if I can't keep that space of love in myself, then my rant and my rave comes up, and now here I am off on another tangent, creating more conflict and stress, where all I had to do was say, oh, okay, no big deal, we'll just let that go. Difference in night and day, having tools, it's certainly what we're looking to take to every mind, heart, and being on the planet.
Yes, and And in that process, as you say, every single day is that it's not always Dr. Feelgood as we go through healing what we've been holding on to, and that even then we can learn to set a loving filter toward our healing process. You know, even it's we're that big, we're that capable. We can say, I feel, I'm really going through a healing event right now, and I'm going to have enthusiasm for, you know, even though I'm in my stuff, I'm going
right.
to put a love filter in front of it and continue to do my work and my worksheets until I come out the other side.
Right. And it's interesting, in Aramaic, you are your own neighbor. And that law says keep Rachma for the creator, for neighbor, in order to maintain self. Your non-self is neighbor to your true self. And so you keep Rachma for that part of you as well. And as that happens, that just accelerates the transmutation of anything that's less than love that's in our genes, in our family systems, in our culture.
Awesome. Well, I have followed my guidance to choose this call over the other call that I'm a participant in, but I'm going to go back to that one now and do my best for that one. There's another hour and a half of that call left, I think. So.
Okay, sir. Have a blessed day. We appreciate you.
I appreciate you, too. Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr. Tim.
Right, bye. Beloved. Bless. All right. Well, there's a young man who's just done such awesome work over the last 15 or so years that I've known him. Just amazing. And such a contribution to his family. Those who've been in the communication, did you hear what I think I said workshop? It's Ron's letter that I read of responsibility communication toward his dad. Very, very powerful, well thought out process of healing that Ron's been doing, and just watching him with his wife now. You know, when I first met him, he was single, has just an awesome young lady, a daughter named Grace, and just fabulous to watch what he's done with the work inside of his family system, through his church community he's been teaching. So, accolades and congratulations. Beyond that, Jeannie tells me that our time is up. We got 60 seconds. Well, that means we have to close. So I'll say thank you, Dr. Tim, for being here with us today. And Jeannie has posted on the website the schedule for next summer. That's up and operational, so take a look at it. And beyond that, we're probably sometime in the next few weeks going to spend a little bit of time in St. Louis with our daughter and granddaughter up there and son-in-law. So we'll be getting some time there and doing a series of workshops if all that comes together. So keep an eye if you're in the St. Louis area. In the meantime, create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.